Hello, welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona, and every week I read from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. We've got a big mix of things today. One of them's a really long article, and we'll get to that in the last half of the show. But first, let's cover the must list. Elvira's Spooky Cookbook, Emma Stone as a possible alien, and a new Witcher top this week's must list. A collection of body horror films and Dead Man's Bones album round out our picks for the weekend. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. To quote my favorite podcast, My Favorite Murder, it's spooky Halloween. If you're out at the West Hollywood Halloween Parade, why do they call it a parade? It's just a street fair. And see an Abbott and Costello, say hi. That was Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief. First on our list is Begonia. Is she an alien or just a typical CEO? This question is at the heart of director Yorgos Lanthimos' twisty new film. Emma Stone plays Michelle Fuller, the powerful leader of a pharmaceutical company, Axolith, who gets kidnapped by Teddy, played by Jesse Plemons, a conspiracy theorist convinced Michelle is really an Andromedan, an extraterrestrial sent to Earth to destroy it. Come to see Stone get her head shaved, stay for big laughs, darkly incisive commentary, and incredible performances from Stone, Plemons, and newcomer Aidan Delbis in this absurdist black comedy. The Witcher is next. Fans lamented when Henry Cavill announced his exit as monster hunter Geralt. Liam Hemsworth picks up the White Wolf's blades on season 4 of the Netflix series that also stars Lawrence Fishburne, and the suspense is killing us. Not like a basilisk, but maybe a drowner. Elvira's Cookbook from Hell. Halloween lovers and year-round spooky chefs rejoice. The Mistress of the Dark's tome of frightening recipes lets you cast the perfect spell in the kitchen. Deliciously dark meals include Dead Man's Corpse Loaf, barbecued bat wings, and spookgetti and eyeballs, which pair with creepy cocktails. Body horror on Criterion Channel. Bored with tried and true Halloween classics? The Criterion Channel's body horror collection features macabre stories involving a woman and her tentacled creature lover, that's possession, a woman self-reproducing odd children through rage, that's the brood, and more disturbing visuals that will keep you up all night. And we have Dead Man's Bones' Dead Man's Bones. Before La La Land and I'm Just Ken, there were zombies. Ryan Gosling's 2009 one-off album with his pal Zach Shields and the Silver Lake Conservatory Children's Choir is the perfect Halloween soundtrack. A monster ghost love story that's equal parts sweet and spooky. That's our must list this week, Elvira's Spooky Cookbook, Emma Stone as a possible alien, and a new Witcher topped this week's must list. There were some linked sidebar stories, is what I would call them, and so I'm going to get to those right now. Emma Stone on shaving her head in one take for Begonia, and the weird cream she had to wear for months. This is by Lauren Huff. Playing a high-powered CEO who may also be an undercover alien is tough work. Just ask Emma Stone, who plays such a character in director Yorgos Lanthimos' Begonia. In the absurdist black comedy, Stone stars as Michelle Fuller, the powerful CEO of a pharmaceutical company named Axolith, who is kidnapped by Teddy, played by Jesse Plemons, a conspiracy theorist convinced that Michelle is really an Andromedan, an extraterrestrial sent to Earth to destroy it. After ambushing Fuller at her mansion, Teddy and his accomplice and cousin, Don, played by Aiden Delbus, knock her unconscious with the tranquilizer and load her into the back seat of her own car. But before they can drive her back to their home and chain her up in the basement, they have to shave off her hair, which they believe is really a communication device she can use to contact her mothership. So, Don handles the electric clippers in the back seat while Teddy speeds away from the crime scene. Asked what was going through her mind as her co-star removed her signature red locks, Stone tells Entertainment Weekly, "Stay still. That was it. I was meditating on stay still. Just stay still." Since the scene had to be filmed in one take, the star says she was so afraid that she'd accidentally ruined the moment by opening her eyes or flinching. "Because I'm not awake there. I was like, play dead. Basically, play dead," she says. If anything went wrong with the take, Stone says there was no backup plan. It was one take, and there were four cameras set up just to make sure, she says. Luckily, they got the moment in one shot, and Lanthimos credits his star with being on board with the major makeover from the beginning. "Not difficult at all, really," he says, when asked if it was hard convincing Stone to shave her head. "I mean, it was in the script, so I didn't even have to tell her. She read it first, and she had the slightest hesitation just before. Not hesitation to do it, but she kind of had a knot in her stomach. But it happened. Thankfully, we did it. We only had one shot to achieve it, and then she felt great. She saw herself and she really loved it, and she felt very free." In fact, Lanthimos thought his star looked so amazing with the new do, he even tried to convince her to keep it. But she wouldn't have it, he says. She had enough of dealing with months of having to also hide her head while we were filming. Still, a shaved head wasn't the only obstacle Stone had to deal with, thanks to Teddy's bizarre beliefs. After removing Fuller's communication device, her kidnapper next endeavors to dull her alien powers by regularly applying thick layers of lotion over her body. It was a combination of creams, and there were so many tests of all different ones because it goes through all different layers, Stone explains of the process. And turns out, human skin hovers around 98.6 degrees, and that's a melting point for a lot of creams. So making that stuff last all day? Tricky. The pores take it in, it thins out. So it was a combination of things, depending on the day, different foundations, moisturizers. It was a fun test, though. Stone credits hair and makeup designer Torsten Witt with doing God's work in nailing the concoction, which she had to slather on every day for months, until it transitioned to blood, she teases. Yeah, it was either cream or blood. Physical discomforts aside, Stone says she was immediately fascinated by her character. It feels truly like Teddy and Michelle are two heroes unto themselves that are both here to save the world in completely different ways and from completely different backgrounds, clearly, and from totally different viewpoints that have this tension against each other, but could really teach each other a couple things, potentially, if they were able to hear each other. Or if it was a circumstance that wasn't so kidnappy, she says. I found her so fascinating because she's sort of glazy. Everything's lovely and everything's fine, but it's all just an empty word, salad-y exercise, she continues. It is always interesting to me to hear people who are the heads of these companies that are like, we need to say this specific set of things, and her using those tactics to then negotiate with Teddy in this really intense situation in the basement. I found it really, really funny and sad, and it was just true in so many ways. Begonia hit theaters everywhere on Friday. That was Emma Stone on shaving her head in one take for Begonia and the weird cream she had to wear for months. It was by Lauren Huff. Another sidebar article relates to The Witcher, Liam Hemsworth on Henry Cavill Witcher comparisons. I felt this pressure to put on a bunch of size. This is exclusive to Entertainment Weekly, and it's by Nick Romano. There's a moment on The Witcher Season 4 when Liam Hemsworth visibly locks into a fight scene as the new Geralt of Rivia. It involves a oneer, the kind of continuous unbroken shot that has become the bread and butter of the fantasy drama, based on the novels by Polish author Andrzej Sapkowski. It's a rain-drenched night sequence a few episodes in, and the White Wolf must cut through upwards of 15 to 20 soldiers in rapid-fire succession. Originally, the choreography called for Hemsworth to headbutt an attacker and throw him to the ground. I was just dialing into this emotional state that the character was in, the frustration and the anger and everything, Hemsworth tells Entertainment Weekly. I went to the stunt coordinator and said, I want to add 3 headbutts to that last headbutt. He kind of laughed. I was like, no, seriously, I want to add a few more. The multi-headbutt made it into the final cut. It was such a rewarding thing to nail a sequence like that and also add to it, he adds. It took a while for Hemsworth to feel at home as Geralt after he was cast as Henry Cavill's successor for the final 2 seasons. Season 4 premiered on Netflix on October 30th, while filming wraps on the 5th and final season next month. As he explains in his first interview on the matter for Entertainment Weekly's The Witcher cover story, Hemsworth didn't want to emulate everything Cavill did on the role. He says, I wanted it to be truthful to me and feel like my version of the character. But fear of comparisons lingered in his head, which fed into his early approach. Initially for this, I felt the pressure or this need that I had to put on a bunch of size and be really big, Hemsworth explains. He does, however, acknowledge the obvious thing about being one of the Hollywood Hemsworths. I'm naturally a tall person anyway, the 6'3" Aussie actor adds, but I did feel this comparison thing popping around in your head. The Hunger Games alum, however, was recovering from a few scrapes at the time. He makes note of both a knee and shoulder injury. The quicker I put on size, the more dysfunctional my body was feeling, he recalls. I wasn't moving as fast, and the weightlifting I was doing at the time was adding to the pressure on these joints. Through filming on Season 4, Hemsworth was simultaneously working through physical therapy to repair his injuries, while finding a balance with his Geralt training that felt both authentic to the character and functional for himself. The first thing I do is physicality, and then a big part of this character is the voice and where that sits, he points out. I spent a good few months with a dialect coach, good friend of mine, Neil Swain. We played with a lot of different things to find a place that didn't feel too affected. The other big thing was the wig. Geralt's signature look always comes with long silver locks, so picking up Cavill's sword also meant picking up his wig. That was one of my biggest concerns, to be honest, Hemsworth says. It doesn't matter how well I play this character, if the wig doesn't look right and the physicality doesn't look right, then it's gonna be for nothing. The team tried a few different styles and fits with the wig, hunting for the most authentic look. None of them, Hemsworth clarifies, made him feel like they were in trouble. They just needed time to find the right one. At the end of the day, fans of The Witcher and of Cavill will likely compare and contrast the former and current Geralts on their own. Even Hemsworth acknowledges, there's definitely going to be similarities using the certain way his character holds himself as an example. I didn't want the comparison to be part of anything that I was doing. Initially, I watched his seasons. I had to let go of that and focus on my journey and the story I was telling. That was Liam Hemsworth on Henry Cavill Witcher comparisons, and it was by Nick Romano. We do have a review. It's a television review. Nobody Wants This Season 2. Netflix's rom-com struggles to find its second act. Adam Brody and Kristen Bell return as interfaith soulmates in Season 2 of Nobody Wants This. In an interview last month with Entertainment Weekly, Jenny Connor, one of the new showrunners for Nobody Wants This, teased what fans can expect in Season 2 of the hit Netflix rom-com. "I didn't want to change the show at all. I loved it," said Connor, who we know from Girls, who headed up the Emmy-nominated Kristen Bell and Adam Brody comedy alongside fellow showrunner Bruce Eric Kaplan. "I was just like, more of the same." Well, we can't say she didn't warn us. Indeed, Season 2 of Nobody Wants This, which chronicles the interfaith romance between Rabbi Noah Rockloff, played by Brody, and Joanne Williams, played by Bell, a podcaster and certified Gentile, is familiar to a fault. The new episodes reveal a show that's chosen narrative stasis rather than risk developing its characters and premise beyond the safe boundaries established in Season 1. The saving grace is Nobody's excellent ensemble cast, which elevates the predictable material into a breezy and pleasant, if not particularly memorable, viewing experience. After their swoony kiss in the Season 1 finale, Noah and Joanne are now enjoying a big, beautiful, healthy relationship. They're having regular sleepovers, hosting their first dinner party, and generally being loved up and psychotically annoying, as Joanne's sister and podcast co-host Morgan, played by Justine Loop, describes it. But their bubble of bliss pops when Joanne learns that Noah still believes she will convert to Judaism eventually, which is something she's not ready to promise. It's unclear how this rather large misunderstanding happened. Surely Noah and Joanne didn't just jump into couple mode without another conversation about the major barrier to their relationship's future. Either way, they know exactly what they want to do about it. Nothing. "I don't want to deal with this," says Joanne with a sigh. "I don't want to deal with it either," he replies. There's certainly an authenticity to this development. Who among us hasn't procrastinated when facing an uncomfortable decision? But it leaves Noah and Joanne in a kind of cutesy holding pattern. For much of the 10-episode season, the central couple encounters a relatively minor relationship obstacle. Example, she worries he gives all his girlfriends the same piece of jewelry. He's shocked she has no plans to celebrate her mom, Lynn, played by Stephanie Farrisee, on her birthday. Disagree about it and ultimately move past it. Rinse, repeat, until the final 3 episodes, when Nobody Wants This allows Noah and Joanne to stop running from their reality. Until then, the show gets by on the charm of its supporting characters, including Noah's brother Sasha, played by Timothy Simons, and sister-in-law Esther, played by Jackie Tone, a married couple long past the honeymoon stage. Sasha and Esther initially offered a comedic contrast to Noah and Joanne's nascent love story. But this season, the show goes deeper into the work it takes to stay married, even to your best friend. Simons and Tone have a relaxed and entertaining bicker-banter chemistry as an on-screen couple, and they're equally funny apart. One of the chief joys of Nobody Wants This Season 2 is watching the characters interact outside of their romantic couples, like Joanne giving Morgan a hard time about her new boyfriend, Dr. Andy, played by Succession's Arian Moyed, Noah getting pushback on his domineering mother, Bina, played by Tova Felsche, or Sasha and Morgan concocting an elaborate story to convince the guy at Apple's Genius Bar, played by Juan Ayala, to break into someone's cell phone for them. The latter scene is hilarious and further solidifies Loop's status as the series MVP. Of course, Noah and Joanne know they can't ignore the conversion question forever, and nobody wants this knows it too. The issue comes to a head during a group hang at a beer garden in the aptly titled Crossroads, written by Connor and Megan Mazur. Crossroads is the name of the episode. It's the penultimate and strongest episode of the season, a fact that makes the finale, which will give viewers serious deja vu, feel even more disappointing. Connor and Kaplan have made it their mission to give audiences what they want, and that's fine. It's not going to happen, though, if they don't let Noah and Joanne and the show itself evolve. Change is scary, but it's also necessary for survival. Nobody Wants This Season 2 premiered Thursday, October 23rd on Netflix. That was Nobody Wants This Season 2's review, Netflix's rom-com struggles to find its second act, and it was by Kristen Baldwin. Michael J. Fox addresses notorious Back to the Future goof that fans still hound him about. Fox notes in his new memoir, Future Boy, that the film's diehard fans have raised the specter of the temporal anachronism to him again and again. This is by Ryan Coleman. For most, time travel movies provide great escapist fun. For others, they're just minefields of aggravating anachronisms. In his new memoir about the making of the 1985 sci-fi comedy classic Back to the Future, Future Boy, that was just released, star Michael J. Fox breaks the narrative at multiple points to sing the praises of the film's enduringly loyal fans. But he's aware that the flip side of close and attentive watching is scrutiny of even the film's most minor mistakes. Case in point, the iconic scene in which Fox's time-traveling teenager Marty McFly fills in for the injured guitarist in a 1955 prom band and launches into rocking renditions of Earth Angel and Johnny B. Goode, channeling pioneering rock legend Chuck Berry. To play Johnny B. Goode, Marty borrowed Marvin Berry's Gibson ES-345, a guitar first introduced in 1958, 3 years after the 1955 scene in the movie. Fox explains, calling the goof a temporal inconsistency that guitar aficionados and Back to the Future fans have pointed out again and again. Fox writes, "Granted, this is noteworthy only for the thousands of future heads who clock every detail in the movie and parse every quirk in the timeline continuum. But staying real, a film like Back to the Future, which continues to generate repertory screenings, inspire fan conventions, and sell merchandise like a newly released blockbuster, has a fan base comprised of more than a few obsessives." Fox clarifies that where the Johnny B. Goode guitar is concerned, there's no cinematic Easter egg intended here. The film's art department simply picked up the ES-345 because it evoked the iconic wine-red axe that Chuck Berry famously duck-walked across stages all over the world. Fox is right. Guitar heads and future devotees alike have taken note of the production flub, even pointing out, like the ES-345, Berry's Johnny B. Goode wouldn't be released until 1958. It would track that Marty knows the tune, coming from 1985, but how would his 1955 backing band know to accompany him on a song that wasn't yet written? In any case, Fox notes that both the 55 and 58 versions of the Gibson Electric are rare and beautiful instruments. For me, it makes little difference which I played. I've always loved the Gibson E-line, big, imposing guitars, yet hollow-bodied and therefore lightweight. Even a little guy like yours truly could sling 'em and fling 'em and still make 'em sing. It's an exciting time to be someone who hyperfixates on this particular Back to the Future flub. In June, Gibson announced a global search for the guitar that Marty plays in the film, which Fox notes in Future Boy. In the decades since the movie's release, the guitar used in Johnny B. Goode has grown more important for what it isn't than what it is. What it isn't is available, which is to say, it's missing. In its announcement, the instrument maker explained that during the making of the sequel to the film, the filmmakers went to look for the guitar, and it was nowhere to be found. Now, music fans worldwide have the chance to help Gibson find the most important guitar in cinema history. Fox and several of his co-stars, including Leah Thompson and Christopher Lloyd, added their voices to the company's plea, encouraging fans to visit www.losttothefuture.com with any tips. To celebrate this year's 40th anniversary of the film's premiere, Back to the Future is returning to theaters on November 7th, and the full trilogy is receiving a new 4K steelbook release loaded with special features. That was Michael J. Fox addresses notorious Back to the Future goof that fans still hound him about, and it was by Ryan Coleman. So Michael J. Fox has that book. Cameron Crowe also has a book out. This article is about how he details prank calls to Cary Grant and Lucille Ball. "Don't call me again, you a-hole." The director recalls in his new memoir how Grant vanquished me without even breaking a sweat, and how Ball gave him a very stern response. Cameron Crowe is looking back on the night he prank-dialed Hollywood legends Cary Grant and Lucille Ball. In his new memoir, The Uncool, which hit bookshelves recently, the rock journalist and director behind such films as Almost Famous and Elizabethtown recalls his experience calling up Grant and Ball as a teenager after plucking their numbers from his friend and fellow journalist's address book. At the time, his pal Maureen was dating Grant, and after Crowe promised not to get her in any trouble, gave him his Girl Friday actor's private phone number. "I dialed after 3 rings. Cary Grant picked up the phone. 'Hello,' said Cary Grant, in only the way Cary Grant says hello," Crowe wrote. "I took on the persona of a drunken drug dealer or street character. 'What's going on, man?' Grant, however, didn't blink an eye in response to the prank call, thoughtfully responding even when Crowe attempted to catch the actor off guard with increasingly outlandish tactics. 'What you doing, man? You need anything? Need anything at all?' Now I pretended I was talking to somebody else in the room. 'Stop it! Put that gun down,' Crowe remembered. 'Well, that would be a shame,' said Cary Grant, 'if that gun went off.' When Crowe explained that the imaginary gunman was his pal Tommy, he noted that Grant simply commented, 'Well, that can't be good. What else can I do for you?' And Crowe was suddenly very aware that he'd lost their war of wits. In less than a minute, Cary Grant had disabled my prank with delicious good humor, he wrote. "He was ready for more, but I panicked. 'Take care, man,' I sputtered. 'I'm gonna go get high with Tommy.' He quickly hung up the call as Maureen and the photographer Neil Preston laughed, admitting, 'Cary Grant had vanquished me without even breaking a sweat.' But Grant wasn't Crowe's only prank victim that evening. He went on to dial Ball next, pretending to be a member of the hospitality staff at the Beverly Hills Hotel. 'Hello,' answered Lucille Ball in a husky, whiskey voice. 'I knew instantly it was her,' he recalled. 'Yes,' I said, thinking quickly. 'This is Mr. Fontaine from the Beverly Hills Hotel.' I winked to Neil and Maureen. I knew this character was good. 'We seem to have found a purse of some kind, and it apparently belongs to you.' The late I Love Lucy actress may have been a comedic legend, but she certainly wasn't laughing at Crowe's gag. 'Don't call me again, you a-hole,' Crowe recalled Ball shouting at him. The 62-year-old genius of television comedy then jackhammered the phone down with incredible force. He added, 'I loved Lucy,' I said, 'but she did not love me.' Now, Crow looks back at his two oddball interactions with the stars fondly. I was always impressed that even on the other end of a prank call, Cary Grant knew the room and how to join the party, he wrote. As for Lucille Ball, all I can tell you is that Martin Scorsese missed a real opportunity when she died. He continued, "Let it be known, I never heard anybody both weaponize and savor the word a-hole with such authentic force since my very brief chat with Lucy." The Uncool, his book, is available now. That was Cameron Crowe detailing prank calls to Cary Grant and Lucille Ball, and it was by Emlyn Travis. Before I get to that long story, I'm going to take a quick break here to say that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly, and I'm reading from their website, which is EW.com. Catching Fire, How Anne Rice's Immortal Universe Expands with New Series Talamasca, The Secret Order. The stars and producers declassify AMC's supernatural spy thriller spin-off following Interview with the Vampire and Mayfair Witches. This is by Sydney Buxbaum. I was scared for my life. Anne Rice's Talamasca, The Secret Order star Nicholas Denton is literally playing with fire on the set of Entertainment Weekly's cover shoot as he burns a surveillance photo of his rookie spy character, Guy Anatole. Of course, all the safety precautions are in place as he ignites the piece of paper, but fire is a living, breathing force of nature. And on this particular take, the flames immediately lick up the side of the prop and almost catch on the fabric of his sleeve. Like a true professional, the actor quickly flicks the photo and extinguishes the blaze without ever breaking character, despite internally freaking out, to nail the perfect shot. I feel like I looked cooler than I actually am, Denton tells Entertainment Weekly a few weeks after the late September cover shoot in New York. I was really trying to be cool in that because fire instantly makes you much cooler than you actually are. It's like magic. That's a feeling Denton is still getting used to, despite living in it for a year since production began on AMC's third TV show based on author Anne Rice's beloved The Vampire Chronicles book series. Following Interview with the Vampire and Mayfair Witches, new spin-off Talamasca, The Secret Order, premiering with two episodes on October 26th on AMC and AMC+, explores the titular shadowy organization featured in both existing shows and many of Rice's books that tracks and controls vampires, witches, and other supernatural creatures around the world. But unlike the previous two series, Talamasca follows a completely original story not pulled from any particular novel. As new character Guy is recruited, well, more like forced into the order to carry out a clandestine mission in which the tenuous peace between mortals and immortals hangs in the balance. Much like his newcomer character, Denton says he didn't know anything about Rice's expansive world before getting cast as Guy, other than the fact that fellow Australian actor Sam Reed stars as Lestat de Liancourt on Interview with the Vampire, which launched the Immortal Universe in 2022, and is rebranding as the Vampire Lestat for Season 3 in 2026. But at the start of his nearly nine-month audition process, Denton quickly learned from showrunners John Lee Hancock and Mark Lafferty that he didn't need to know anything about Interview with the Vampire or Mayfair Witches, or even Rice's novels, because Talamasca is for new viewers as much as it caters to superfans of the author's works. In fact, the six-episode first season deals more in vintage 1960s and 70s spy tropes, as it pulls back the curtain on how the organization operates in the shadows to control all supernatural creatures. We are kind of a different Talamasca than what people think of, Denton says. Ours feels more like a fully-fledged business that had a payroll room and a janitor's area. I was like, man, I don't know if this fits into the Mayfair or interview world. There's something sacred about Anne Rice. We're trying to make sure that Anne Rice is honored in all ways, but also trying to invite a lot of other people into this world because there is a lot to explore. Executive producer Mark Johnson, who oversees AMC's entire Anne Rice Immortal Universe, warns that even the most dedicated fans have no idea what's coming. They may know about what the organization is, and they may know some great stories about some loyal and disloyal agents of the Talamasca, Johnson says. More on that later. But there isn't a Talamasca book. And that's exactly why this new series was created. Throughout the development of 3 seasons of Interview with the Vampire and 2 seasons of Mayfair Witches, Johnson became intrigued about the organization that kept popping up at pivotal moments in the story, yet was never fully explored in Rice's books. We've often said it's sort of like a dramatic or non-comical version of Men in Black, Johnson says, and I just thought, surely there's a show in here. The executive producer approached his good friend and acclaimed filmmaker John Lee Hancock, who we know from The Blind Side, The Rookie, and Saving Mr. Banks, to helm this new series alongside co-showrunner Mark Lafferty, with the goal of not rewriting, but rather expanding on the idea Rice first created in her books. Whenever Mark calls with an idea, you pay close attention, Hancock says. It was just this idea based on different chapters, sometimes short descriptions of the Talamasca in Anne Rice's books. And Mark and executive producer Tom Williams sent along all these different pieces from books to read. As I read them, I was taken with the spy aspect of it, to be honest. As a big fan of espionage dramas, Hancock quickly saw an opportunity to create a spy show that dealt in the world of the supernatural, different from what Rice fans have already seen in the previous 2 shows. Can those 2 genres meld? He remembers wondering. I was hopeful that they could, so I sat down to write about secrets and shadows and loneliness and all the things that the supernatural world and spies have in common. Hancock wanted to declassify the mystery of the Talamasca by having this spinoff answer all the logistical questions he personally had about the organization, right down to the spies' training and salaries, in order to bring the hermetically sealed world of Rice vampires and witches out into the grounded pavement of the streets around us. I didn't want to start the show in Oz, Hancock explains. I wanted to start in Kansas and take Dorothy and throw her in and have her come across various people on the yellow brick road that we recognize from Anne's work. The Dorothy, in this case, is Denton's guy Anatole, pulled from relative obscurity just as he's about to graduate law school and begin a very normal career, as long as he ignores those pesky voices inside his head. He believes those are just a symptom of a debilitating mental illness managed with a steady diet of pills. But seasoned Talamasca agent Helen, who is Downton Abbey's Elizabeth McGovern, who runs the New York branch, approaches Guy to recruit him into the organization after a trusted colleague is murdered. She also reveals they've been secretly tracking and manipulating him for his entire life due to his mind-reading abilities, uncovering decades of shocking lies about his family and own mind. Thrown by this revelation, Guy only agrees to join the Talamasca and follow Helen's orders in order to learn the truth about who and what he is. Quite frankly, he's adrift and he has to find something to latch onto, and unfortunately, he has to latch onto the organization that ruined his life, Denton says. They're the ones that have the knowledge, so he has to join them. He is the reluctant spy, and that's great because the reluctant spy doesn't want to be there. So they're a bit surly, like, I don't belong here. I'm completely ill-equipped to be a spy. Don't do this to me. And what the hell is a vampire? I like the skepticism of Guy against the certainty of Helen. As Guy leaves behind his former life and accepts his new reality as a spy in a supernatural world that he knows nothing about, Helen becomes his absolute lifeline in the Talamasca, McGovern says. But she also warns that Helen isn't just a helpful mentor for the new recruit. Their relationship is part friendship, part mother. I think she does care about him a lot, but she's also using him. But she feels as if she's using him in a way that's beneficial toward him. Helen's own mysterious history and goals will be made clearer throughout the season as you come to find that this is as much about her own journey as it is about Guy's, Lafferty reveals. And McGovern loved sinking her teeth into the character who might not be totally moral. Almost as much as she loved putting on a pair of trousers rather than my Downton Abbey rags, she added with a smile. This is quite new for me, McGovern explains. I'm so often cast as the obvious good person. I spent much of my career being the perfect girlfriend, and then as I got older, being the perfect wife. And then as I got older, being the perfect mother, and then God knows where I go from here. So I've liked the possibility of a Machiavellian kind of ulterior motive. That's been quite fun. Denton praises his co-star for bringing a surprising warmth to Helen that adds a delicious layer to her questionable character. You don't know if you can trust her, but you really want to trust her, he adds. You really want her to be Guy's friend and confidant and kind of sidekick in this, but they're all out for their own needs. There's more and more lies, and it's so sad. Who do you trust is the ultimate question for any spy, and that doesn't just apply to Helen. Guy soon finds he can actually get more honest answers from the quote-unquote villain of the story, Jasper, played by William Fichtner. That is, if he can survive their conversations. Something evil's lurking in the dark. In Rice's books, revenant vampires are terrifying, mindless, feral monsters. But on the Manchester set of Talamasca, they somehow know the dance to Michael Jackson's Thriller. One night, we were halfway through the shoot, and all the revenants were on the set, Denton remembers, of Jasper's small army of special vampires. And they all, unbeknownst to me, decided to learn the choreography to Thriller. The on-set paramedic decided to put on the ambulance's red and blue lights, and so they stopped the shoot and decided to do a 5-minute fully choreographed version of Thriller. They looked like complete psychopaths dancing in the middle of the street. It was like a flash mob of revenants. While the vibe on the set with the revenants was all laughs, the only character on Talamasca who will be having any kind of fun with them is Jasper. When viewers first meet the mysterious American vampire in the series premiere, he is, very clearly, a dangerous force. Jasper has quietly taken over the Talamasca's London branch for his own secret plans, and he's able to control his own special breed of revenant vampires to carry out acts of violence against anyone who gets in his way. He's definitely not a good guy, but he is an honest one, and that's very attractive to somebody like Guy, who all of a sudden can't trust anyone or anything in this new reality. In a world of lies, I needed one person who was kind of a truth teller, and I thought, who better than the person who set you up as your antagonist at the beginning to do all that, Hancock says. Now, you may not like some of the things he tells you, but they are always the truth. He never lies. And that's something that's admirable, even when it's coming from someone who's doing bad things. Compared to the antagonists from the other two Immortal Universe shows, Jasper comes from humble, relatable beginnings. Hancock describes him as a middle-class vampire from a small town in Texas. It's not playing opera music all the time, the velvet cloaks, and those kinds of things, the showrunner adds. I was very taken with the idea of someone who's good and, well, pissed off, not only at the world in the Talamasca, but also probably some other vampires. I don't have to have written a vampire before to write a vampire with these issues because they're human issues. When Helen's top secret mission for Guy sends him directly into Jasper's orbit, a treacherous new dynamic sparks as Guy tries to figure out who he can trust more between the two players in this larger war. I've played tough guys, I've played rough guys, but I've never played anything quite like this, Feichner says, teasing that Episode 5 really is a real rocket ship for Jasper and Guy's relationship. And expect to question whether Jasper actually is the villain he appears to be at the beginning. He's a pretty dastardly dude, Lafferty admits, but villains who are just mustache twisty are not very interesting. We tried to see just how far we could take Jasper. He believes in something, he has principles, and he has a plan, and it's not crazy. He has a true theory of the world and how it should be run. It makes sense in the context of where he came from. This is a story that is ultimately about families and about families that have been broken apart, whether it's Helen or Guy or Jasper. The creators actually took more inspiration from British espionage author Jean Le Carré's work than Rice's, as they filled out all the corners of the world of the Talamasca in shades of gray. So much of the point of Le Carré's stuff is, as you get deeper and deeper into an organization, you start to see that you have more in common with the guy at your level who's on the opposite side of the fence than you do with the people who are giving you the orders, Lafferty says. At some level, you're starting to lose sight of what the mission is and what's good and bad and who's right and wrong. Is Jasper the villain or is he kind of a hero? Is the Talamasca good or bad? There aren't easy answers to any of those questions. Good luck figuring that out, Guy. Off the books. When a celebrity entered the world of Talamasca, it caused quite the commotion on set. As Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Daniel Molloy, played by Eric Bogosian, fresh off becoming a vampire in the Interview with the Vampire season 2 finale, continues his book tour in New York City, he crosses paths with Guy in the series premiere for the show's first official crossover. I knew that was a really big deal, Denton says. We had paparazzi and people were trying to snap photos during this scene. Everyone was trying to get photographs of Eric, and he had to be quite tight-lipped because there were certain things that were happening to his character in the next season of Interview with the Vampire that couldn't really be at odds with what we were shooting with his character in Talamasca. Filmed over the course of one night, Guy and Daniel meet in one intense scene in an alleyway outside of the bookstore as Guy continues to investigate the Talamasca. While the details of their conversation are, of course, confidential, Bogosian teases that the two characters have more in common than they first believe, especially when it comes to the Talamasca interfering with their lives. The Talamasca have a heavy hand in this book, Hancock reveals, and Molloy might not be completely pleased with that. But Bogosian says that Daniel knows a little more about what the organization is capable of than this naive new spy, especially after his exploits on the other show. Daniel's willing to talk with him a little bit, at least give him a clue, Boghossian says. Daniel wouldn't mind sucking the blood out of him, but he does have a final scrap of empathy in him. I could feel like a tiny vestige of sympathy for this fool who's going to basically get himself in a lot of trouble. I'm pretty much telling him that he has no idea what he's walking into, and then I tell him, "You better leave before I kill you." And Daniel is just the first familiar face coming into this season. Fans will also recognize the shady, opportunistic Talamasca agent Raglan James, played by Justin Kirk, first seen in Interview with the Vampire Season 2, who pops up in Episode 4 on a collision course with Guy. Raglan's always looking out for himself and is a real lone wolf, Lafferty says. There is something that our main character Guy has been tasked to retrieve, and it might be that Raglan is on a similar pursuit. Guns, vampires, hotel rooms, Denton teases of Raglan's chaotic crossover episode. It'll scare Guy. It's quite a fun ride because you can't trust Raglan. There's nothing that presents on the surface that seems like a trustworthy individual. He's the most slippery character I've ever had to work across from. His performance is so bizarre that it's genius. He is just a massive quandary. While Raglan and Malloy are vastly different characters, Denton reveals that Guy ultimately learns the same lesson from them both as he delves deeper into the world of the Talamasca. Watch your back. The Talamasca showrunners worked closely with the other Immortal Universe producers to figure out which characters and storylines can weave together across all three series. It was a little bit like kids getting together on Christmas Day, Lafferty says. There are certain parts of this story that are meaningful in these other stories and can suggest that the whole universe is sort of talking to each other. And there's one more exciting crossover moment that the Talamasca showrunners managed to fit into the first season. However, this Easter egg from Interview with a Vampire, or more specifically, the vampire Lestat, is much more subtle than Boghossian and Kirk's on-screen appearances. If a viewer is listening very closely in Episode 5, they might hear something coming through the speakers of a bar that is a direct tie to another of the series, and might also give somebody some residuals from Talamasca, Lafferty teases. If they're listening at just the right time, they might just hear a track or two that comes from Lestat. As the Brat Prince himself would say, "Siri, volume up." A new chapter. Talamasca charts new territory for Rice's works nearly 50 years after she first began publishing her gothic vampire novels, and producers already have plans to continue adapting her books into more shows. "You bet there is a list," Johnson says, "of potential additional spin-offs. There are so many good ideas. She is an extraordinary writer, and that much more extraordinary when you realize when she was writing. It's really so far ahead of her time." Johnson teases that they have 3 or 4 other titles and subjects they'd like to pursue based on Bryce's Vampire Chronicles. "I go to AMC every 3 months and say, 'You ready for another? Ready for another?' And so we'll have one soon enough. I think an Anne Rice aficionado could probably figure out which ones are most likely in the next line, but I think I'd better keep the titles to myself right now." The current focus is launching third series Talamasca with the hope of continuing the spy tale into a second season. Maisie Richardson Sellers, who stars in the first season as ambitious Talamasca agent Olive, reveals that these first 6 episodes are a perfect setup for the next chapter of the show, if it gets renewed. It starts quite intimate, and it just grows and grows and grows until by the end, it's a real crescendo, she says. It ramps up, and it will leave you, I hope and believe, really gunning for season two, and I think it's only going to get bigger and better. Denton adds, it's not a fairy tale, it's very messy. It is that psychological and emotional kind of roller coaster. There's a lot of sadness that comes with the parting of certain people. It's very heartbreaking, but there's some fantastic performances in there. It made me very excited because there's a lot more to explore in this series. Let's just hope Guy doesn't get burned in the process. That was Catching Fire, how Anne Rice's immortal universe expands with the new series Talamasca, The Secret Order, and it was by Sydney Buxbaum. And that about wraps us up for all the time we have for Entertainment Weekly. That was a long article. I said it would be in the last half of the show. I didn't think it would be the entire last half of the show, but it fit perfectly. Thank you all for listening today. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please come back next week and we will have more Entertainment Weekly and articles from their website, which is ew.com. Until then, goodbye.